The Eternal Light, a program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today's program, Some Fascinating Minor Figures in the Bible, is the first in this Eternal Light series of four talks by Maurice Samuel, author and lecturer, based on his book, Certain People of the Book. Mr. Samuel.
I must begin by saying that I find this a rather difficult assignment. The difficulty lies in the fact that whenever I read to an audience, visible or invisible, something I've written, I want to make changes as I go along. I suddenly get new ideas, and I'd like to incorporate them in the text. The trouble is, once you've published a book there, the wretched thing is, you may get a chance to make changes in a second edition, but in the third edition you won't like those changes. It goes on like that for the third and fourth editions, if you're lucky enough to get them. And if you're anything like me, the older you grow, the less you like what you've published. So I shall make changes in the text of certain people of the book as I read from it to you. I shall introduce new characters whom I shouldn't have left out. I shall touch up old characters by whom I didn't do right, as it now seems to me. The fact is that as I keep rereading the Bible, I find myself seeing even the most familiar characters in a new light. And I suppose this will go on as long as I live. And if you keep reading and rereading the Bible, you probably have the same experience. One figure that I feel I've slighted, and I can't forgive myself for it, is the prophet Elisha. I don't place him among the major figures, but there was one incident in his busy career that I ought to have treated at greater length. I am referring to Elisha's curing of Naaman and to the role of Gehazi, Elisha's servant. For those of you who are not familiar with the details of that incident, let me condense the relevant part of the Bible text. Naaman, the generalissimo of the Syrian armies, was a leper. It so happened that the Syrians, in their raids on Israel, captured a little girl, whose name we aren't given, and she became the servant of Naaman's wife. This little girl had the temerity to suggest to her mistress that if Naaman went to see Elisha the prophet in Israel, he would find a cure for his leprosy. And so we read, Naaman came with his horses and with his chariots and stood at the door of the house of Elisha. And Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and thy flesh shall come back to thee, and thou shalt be clean. And Naaman was angry and said, I thought he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and recover the leper. Anat Ammana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the rivers of Israel? May I not wash in them and be clean? And he went away in a rage. As you see, Naaman was offended because he wasn't treated with the circumstantiality and protocol due to a distinguished patient. He expected something dramatic in keeping with his exalted rank. It was beneath his dignity to accept a simple and untheatrical diagnosis and prescription. Fortunately, there were among Naaman's officers some men of sense who said to him, My father, if the prophet had bid thee do some great thing, wouldst thou not have done it? How much rather then when he said to thee, Wash and be clean? Well then, Naaman swallowed his pride and followed Elisha's instructions and bathed 7 times in the Jordan, and his flesh came back like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. Thereupon we read, He returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and stood before him. That is to say, Elisha came out of his house this time. And Naaman said, Behold now, I know there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. Now therefore, I pray thee, take a present of thy servant. But Elisha said, As the Lord liveth before whom I stand, I will receive none. And Naaman urged him to take it, but Elisha refused. And Naaman said, If not, yet I pray thee, let there be given to thy servant 2 mules burden of earth. For thy servant will henceforth offer neither burnt offering nor sacrifice unto other gods, but unto the Lord. In this thing the Lord pardon thy servant. When my master, meaning the king of Syria, goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, and he leans on my hand, and I prostrate myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon thy servant in this thing. And Elisha said to him, Go in peace. Now you have to conjure up the picture. The mighty captain Naaman appears before the humble house of Elisha the prophet. He is surrounded by his horsemen and his chariots, his aides-de-camp and his staff, and Elisha the prophet sends down a message. Elisha is not impressed. He knows what he has to do, and he does it. And the mighty captain rides off with his horsemen and chariots and entourage, offended, and changes his mind and follows the prescription of the prophet and is cured and returns to the prophet in all humility a believer. It is a magnificent story. Incidentally, I hope Hollywood will leave it alone. It is too magnificent for pictorial representation. It has too much spiritual greatness. But there was one man present at the episode who didn't see it that way. That man was, of all people, the servant of the prophet, Gehazi. You would imagine that as a servant of the prophet, he had learned something about spiritual values. No, for we read, But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, said, Behold, my master has spared this Naaman in not receiving at his hands that which he brought. As the Lord liveth, I will surely run after him and take somewhat of him. So Gehazi followed after Naaman. And Naaman saw him and alighted from his chariot and said, Is all well? And Gehazi answered, All is well. My master has sent me, saying, There have come to me 2 men from the hill country of Ephraim, 2 young men of the sons of the prophets. Give them, I pray thee, a talent of silver and 2 changes of clothes. And Naaman said, Take 2 talents. And he urged Gehazi, and bound 2 talents of silver in 2 bags, with 2 changes of clothes, and laid them upon 2 of his servants. And when they came to the hill, Gehazi took the clothes and talents of silver, and let the men go. Then Gehazi went in and stood before his master. And Elisha said to him, Whence comest thou, Gehazi? And Gehazi answered, Thy servant went nowhither. And Elisha said, Is this a time to receive money and to receive garments and oliveyards and vineyards and men servants and maidservants? Therefore the leprosy of Naaman shall cleave to thee and to thy seed forever. And Gehazi went out from his presence, a leper as white as snow. That is the story. The classic Jewish commentaries read into it a lesson against greed, and it is that. But it is much more. It is the portrayal of the utterly irreclaimable moral idiot, the man of impenetrable moral obtuseness. Gehazi had just witnessed an overwhelming manifestation of the prophetic power. He had just seen a proud and powerful heathen converted to a belief in the God of Israel. And what struck him instantaneously was the opportunity it offered of making a fast talent of silver. And you couldn't argue with Gehazi. He knew, of course, that it was wrong in a way to run after Naaman and beg for a present. He misused his master's name. He got the present under false pretenses. But what, he asks, is so terrible about that? Why should that Syrian get away with it? What harm did I do? As a matter of fact, this argument of Gehazi's has been thrown at me, and the reproach has been thrown at Elisha that he was too severe with Gehazi. I haven't known what to answer. I can only say there are many of us who, if we heard that God was going to reveal his law a second time at Sinai, would apply for the soft drink concessions. Such may properly be described as the sons of Gehazi, to whom Gehazi's leprosy has come down by inheritance. The Bible never mentions Naaman again, and we don't know what happened to him. I've often wondered what went on in his mind when Gehazi caught up with him and in the name of his master asked for the talent of silver and the 2 changes of clothes. Possibly Naaman smiled into his beard and thought, well, well, the great prophet changed his mind pretty quickly. First, the grand gesture. No, no, I wouldn't dream of taking anything from you for this miracle. And then the regret. A talent of silver is a talent of silver, and 2 changes of clothes are 2 changes of clothes, and every little helps. The possibility that Naaman was driven to such reflections by a miserable little scrounger like Gehazi makes me squirm. Especially that insistence of Naaman's. Take 2 talents. There may have been a touch of irony in it. I can only hope that I am wrong, and that Naaman saw through Gehazi and smiled at him, not at the prophet. Well, this about finishes what I find in the Elisha-Gehazi story at the present time. I hope to find more in the future. But I wouldn't like you to think that I consider the Bible to be nothing more than a collection of remarkable stories. No. The Bible has qualities and values of far greater importance. I am only using the stories in these 4 talks, as Mark Van Doren and I have used it in many other talks, as an introduction to the Bible from the literary point of view. They are stories for adults, and they are stories for children too. I think that once you become interested in these stories as a beginning, you are led on and on to the other and higher values. Here, for instance, is another story which I have treated in Certain People of the Book. It is about 2 women named Shifra and Pua. They were midwives, Jewish midwives, at the time when the Jews, or rather Israelites or Hebrews, were slaves in Egypt, and they saved many Jewish lives. I have come to regard Shifra and Pua as 2 comical figures imbued with the spirit of goodness. That may sound strange to you, goodness under the aspect of the comic, but there's nothing disrespectful about it. There are certain types who make a huge joke of foiling evil in the midst of danger, who make villains look ridiculous as well as evil. I take the view that laughter is one of the ways of combating evil. Now let me give you the setting of the story. A few generations have passed since Jacob and his clan had settled in Egypt at the invitation of the current Pharaoh. The text tells us that the Israelites were fruitful and increased abundantly and waxed exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. That doesn't mean that they filled the land. In fact, we are told that when all the Israelites left Egypt under Moses, there were 600,000 of them, which happens by a striking coincidence to be the number of Jews in Germany when Hitler and the Nazis came to power in Germany. The Nazis were complaining that Germany was full of Jews, although there were over 60 million other inhabitants. The Nazis were also complaining that the Jews had become exceedingly mighty. There may not have been 60 million Egyptians at the time of Moses, but they had the feeling, it seems, that the land was filled with Jews. At any rate, we read in the Bible, there arose a king over Egypt who knew not Joseph. And this king, this Pharaoh, said to his people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are too mighty for us. Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and in the event of war, join themselves to our enemies and fight against us and get out of the land. And so we read, the Egyptians set taskmasters over the Israelites to afflict them with heavy burdens. But the more the Egyptians afflicted them, the more the Israelites multiplied. The Egyptians made the lives of the Israelites bitter with hard service in mortar and in bricks, and still the Israelites kept multiplying. So population control by means of excessive labor having failed, the king of Egypt bethought himself of another plan. We read, he spoke to the 2 Hebrew midwives, one of whom was called Shifra and the other Pua, and he said, when you deliver a son to a Hebrew woman, kill him. And when you deliver a daughter, let her live. At this point, you might have expected a heroic, death-defying answer from the midwives. Far be it from us, O king, followed by martyrdom. You will be disappointed. Shifra and Pua said never a word. They remained silent, and Pharaoh took their silence for consent. And what we read is this: the midwives feared God and did not, as the king commanded them, but saved the men children alive. This went on for some time, and how Shifra and Pua managed, we don't know. Perhaps they bribed a number of officials. But it couldn't go on indefinitely. At a certain point, it became obvious that there were large numbers of new Hebrew boys around. And then we read, the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said, "Why have you done this thing and saved the men children alive?" And the midwife said to Pharaoh, "The Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They are very lively and are delivered before the midwife comes to them." I like to dwell on that answer. The only way I can describe it is as the cheekiest cock-and-bull story ever offered by professional saboteurs to a deceived government. I like to imagine the bland expression on the faces of those two innocent ladies and the baffled expression on Pharaoh's face. He was completely taken in. He did not even punish the midwives for dereliction of duty or malfeasance in office or whatever the right expression would have been. On the contrary, he allowed them to remain in office because we read, "And God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses." We are, incidentally, confronted here with a moral problem. That is, if my reconstruction of the story is a permissible one. May one tell a lie in a good cause? The proper answer seems to be no. Once you tamper with the truth, you spoil the good cause. The classic formulation of the problem is as follows. Suppose a madman with a loaded gun were to ask you where he can find a certain man you know he wants to kill. And suppose you happen to know where that certain man is. What are you supposed to answer? If you say, "I don't know," you're telling a lie. The strictly moral answer should be, "I won't tell you." In that case, the madman will probably kill you. Perhaps you will be told that the truth is worth dying for. But we have to consider other consequences. By telling the truth to that madman, you turn him into a murderer on the spot. I'm afraid it's a highly complicated problem, and I haven't the answer. I might add, not at all in connection with this story, but as a side thought, whenever I hear people speaking of capital punishment, they always speak of the wickedness of killing a human being. They never raise the problem of turning a human being into a killer. Somebody has to be the executioner, whether it's with an axe or by pressing a button, and he is turned into a killer in order to serve justice. He is never mentioned. I have a great affection for the two ladies, Shifra and Pua. They represent to me the unheroic person of saintly character. They don't defy a tyrant. They try instead to fool him. They resort to evasive disobedience. And if there were only enough people like that, we wouldn't need the heroes. Let me close this Shifra Pua episode with an observation on the Pharaoh of the Exodus. In the days of the Tsars, the Jews of Russia used to refer to the Tsar as Pharaoh. A teacher of mine, now long dead, Shmaria Levin, pointed out what a wonderfully apt cognomen that was. Pharaoh kept on promising the Hebrews that he would let them go and kept breaking his promise. The last Russian Tsar, Nicholas II, kept promising freedom to the Russian people and kept breaking his promise. He allowed them to elect a first Duma, or parliament, and dissolved it. He allowed them a second Duma, and he dissolved that too. What happened in the end to Pharaoh and to Nicholas II? They were both drowned in the Red Sea. One was the Red Sea of waters, which lies between Egypt and Arabia. The other was the Red Sea of blood shed by the communists. I am sorry to have to add that this striking and instructive pun couldn't be made in the original language of the Bible. What we call the Red Sea in English is in Hebrew the Yam Suf, the Sea of Reeds, nothing to do with redness. But the parallel between the Pharaohs and the Romanovs is good enough without this pun. There are certain people who, if I may so put it, won't thank you for rescuing them from danger until they've been killed. What I find particularly moving and in a way wryly amusing about Shifra and Pua is that they were not only saving the lives of Israelite children. They were, in effect, trying to save Pharaoh himself by ignoring his monstrous instructions. And when we read that God hardened the heart of Pharaoh, and we seem to think it is unfair, we should reflect that there are perhaps some people who are quite unteachable, even though God made them. If you like, you may call this a lesson in the patience of the Creator. He tries to remake a man over and over again. The material is recalcitrant, and there's only a certain degree of patience and time which it can expend on this individual. And if the material turns out to have been originally inferior and unmalleable, it goes into the discard. Or as Ibsen used to say, it's sent to the button molder. My third figure in today's readings from certain people of the book is again a woman. She's mentioned in the biblical narrative without a name, and to all but careful readers of the Bible, she's as unknown as Shifra and Pua. I can't say that I find her a likable personality, but she's the center of another important problem which some of you may find interesting. The Bible calls her the wise woman of Abel, and we mustn't confuse the name of the town with the Abel who was killed by his brother Cain. The story centers on this wise woman and a man called Sheba, and we mustn't confuse him with the Queen of Sheba. The incident occurred in the reign of King David. Sheba, the son of Bichri, had raised a rebellion against King David among the northern tribes, and David sent out against him his best remaining general, Joab. Sheba, the son of Bichri, threw himself into the town of Abel, and Joab, the general, besieged him. It looked as though the struggle would be long and bloody. Well, here was this woman, this wise woman of Abel, in the besieged town, and the struggle was on. Joab's men, we read, cast up a mound against the city, and all the people that were with Joab battered the wall to break it down. There were the catapults and the battering rams and the scaling ladders and the twanging of arrows and the yelling of the fighters, and suddenly above it all sounded a woman's voice. It must have been a tremendous voice, a thundering and roaring voice, or perhaps a fiercely shrilling voice. In any case, not the kind of voice that we like in a woman. The voice was so powerful that the fighting stopped, and the wise woman of Abel asked for an audience with Joab the general. And it appears that in spite of that terrifying voice of hers, she was of a peaceful disposition. At any rate, she said so. "We are of them," she said, "that are peaceable and faithful in Israel. Dost thou seek to destroy a city and a mother in Israel?" And Joab answered that he did not seek to destroy the city. He only wanted Sheba, the son of Bichri, the rebel against the king. "Deliver him only," said Joab, "and I will depart from the city." Thereupon the woman said, "His head shall be thrown to thee over the wall." And the woman went unto all the people in her wisdom, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. Thereupon Joab disbanded his army and returned to Jerusalem. We don't know why Sheba, the son of Bichri, headed a revolt. It is possible that he had good cause. We don't know either why, having killed Sheba, the son of Bichri, they decapitated him and threw his head over the wall, making it impossible for him to get a decent burial. But these are peripheral questions. The central question is this: has a besieged city the right to save itself by surrendering a designated person to the enemy? Is it a moral thing to kill one man in order that many other men, and also women and children, should be saved from death? Never mind whether the man is good or bad, guilty or innocent of a charge brought against him, Sheba ben Bichri wasn't given a trial. He was simply killed to save the city. I've reformulated the problem in extreme terms, and I offer it to you for solution. Suppose you learn that a certain much-frequented bridge had been mined and was going to be blown up at a fixed moment. And suppose you couldn't get to the bridge in time and you found yourself at a distance of several hundred yards from the bridge. And suppose you had a gun and were a good marksman, and the only way you could frighten the hundreds of walkers on the bridge and get them to run off it was by shooting one or two of them. Ought you to do it? I am assuming that shooting close to them wouldn't be enough. I am assuming that only when they realized that someone was shooting to kill would they run off the bridge. What ought they to do? What ought you to do? The problem seems to be theoretical, but it isn't. It has occurred over and over again in history. It has taken various forms like preventive arrest and four-handed liquidation. Imagine what a difference it would have made to countless millions, including millions of Jews, if a group of foresighted men had killed Hitler and Goering and Goebbels and a few hundred others before they came to power. We are told that freedom of speech may be suspended in the face of clear and present danger. What other laws would be suspended for you if you were the man with the gun and you knew what was going to happen to the people on the bridge? I must tell you that after years of thinking about this problem, I haven't found a satisfactory answer or even a clue to one. In the Jewish traditional commentaries, the problem of Sheba, the son of Bichri, is hotly debated, and the discussion hasn't satisfied me. So I leave it to you, with the promise that in my next talk, I shall take up a pleasanter theme with pleasanter characters. Characters also better known than the woman of Abel, but like her, women.
Just heard the first in this Eternal Light series of four talks by Maurice Samuel, author and lecturer, based on his book, Certain People of the Book, published by Alfred A. Knopf, Incorporated. Be with us again next week for the second program in this Eternal Light series, The Story of Ruth the Moabitess. The Eternal Light is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation. This is the NBC Radio Network.